If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Marcia Bennett Mayall is a UK-based textile artist and stonemason whose iconic images explore her mental health, her personal documentary, and also celebrate significant black figures throughout history. This is the first part of our needle exchange, and it was a complete pleasure to talk with Marcia. We talk about her work, which I've been a massive fan of ever since I first saw it, and how it evolved from being a personal exploration of her own feelings and her own attitudes into a more iconic series of statements about what it is to be a modern black woman living in the UK and how the story of black society has evolved over time. Marcia's work is bold and vibrant, and we talk about how she distills her ideas into these, iconic images, the decisions she makes about colour, how she uses certain motifs in her work, and where the ideas come from, how the process started out as being something very personal and has now become something with a slightly higher perspective on her position within the modern world. It's a great chat. It really is. If you haven't seen Marcia's work, you can find it online, or you can check out this interview on our YouTube channel, where we've got plenty of pieces of her work for you to enjoy. And one of the things I love about Marcia is she contrasts this work with her living as a stonemason, an equally creative act, and she expresses herself with her stonemasonry as well. So she has this real hard and soft work stream happening simultaneously, and she's just got so much to say. It was such a joyful conversation. I was so pleased to have a chat with her. In next week's episode, we dive much further into black history, the position of black people within the art context, stuff that I'm a white guy, no surprises, so I don't know about this stuff, and so I love talking to people who can enlighten me further, and Marcy does a great job of that. But getting ahead of myself, for now, this is the interview with Marcy, the first part of it, and I think you're going to enjoy it. If you do enjoy it, please visit our socials, visit the Mr. X Stitch Instagram, leave a comment, tell me what episode you've liked, tell me how much you like this episode, and by all means, share it with someone else who will enjoy it as well. I'll be back next week with the second part of this chat with Marcia, so until then, enjoy the show. I thought I would open by asking you about your forthcoming exhibition in October at the Brixton Tate Museum. How's it going?
I finished stretching all the textiles. I'm not too sure. It's a big space, and I've got to go and measure the walls because I want to line the walls with coloured card. I found because of exhibiting at the knitting and stitching show back in 22, I asked then if I could have some coloured card behind the work to make them pop, and they said yes, you know, because you couldn't paint the walls, you know. And it seems to work. So whenever I've exhibited now, wherever possible, because I had like three pieces up in down in Hastings in a group textile show. I asked if I can have coloured card behind, because it really makes I call them the girls. Makes the girls.
I'll call them the ladies, if you don't mind. Yes, that you're allowed to call them the girls.
Yeah, the women. They just really pop. So this particular space in Brixton, it's quite a big space. It's an awkward space. But Rosella, the curator for the space, she said, yeah, she's been really, really fantastic about saying, that go ahead. So it's going to make, I want people to just be not overwhelmed, but just really go into this sort of warm space. All these women are looking at you. I have this vision in my head how it's going to be. If I can pull it off, I'll be quite emotional, because for the knitting and stitching show, they had professional guys mount everything for you. I was invited to exhibit, and there's no way I could have afforded that space in that venue. And they did everything. I framed everything, but they mounted it. So when I was watching them mounting, they were like well-oiled machines. It was just in perfect sync with each other, how they moved, and they knew exactly what to do, because obviously they're professionals. But when I stepped back and started to see all the women coming onto the walls, I got really tearful, because it was the first time I'd seen them on mass, and that was only 10, 11 pieces. It was the first time I'd seen them on mass before, ever, and I got really emotional. I've got everything stretched. I do have some other textiles that I've used, I've exhibited already. They might be in the show, I don't know. But I've now got that thing of the cost of framing everything. Because I think I've said before that it's very, very important for me that they're framed. I want to show them that respect. They're very important to me, and as you know, textiles are still that thing of textiles. But not my girls, not my girls. No. my women are going to they're under glass, and don't touch, looky, no, touchy, that's what I said. So, it's the framing now. I've been collecting a lot of secondhand frames and some, surplus frames from picture framers. And so what I tend to do is woodwork myself, patching up like I can, then some are going to be professionally framed with as much as possible. I would like the anti-reflective glass, because it's really great, fabulous stuff for textiles. So that's where I'm at the moment. I'm at the precipice of framing and the costs that involve. So
Are you finding that in the same way as your fabric choices are somewhat driven by the character? Are your framing choices equally, are you seeing some frames and being like, that's exactly going to be right for that particular piece of bone mind?
No, I am Yeah, some really go perfectly together. Mm. But no, I am a bit light with my textiles choices. I am not so precious about the framing for some of them. I kind of like that. Again, with the textiles, you don't know what you're going to get, and if this frame suddenly pops with that one, and then there's also the colour. I do choose. I am a bit more careful with the backing card colour, but I am a wee bit more casual with the framing. But as long as they're, yes, as long as it's aesthetically looking good, I'm not. But with the main textile for this show called Not the Tree Then Check Your Roots, that's the biggest one I've just stretched. Yes, I want that one. I follow several picture framers on Instagram, and there's one in London whose frames are just so beautiful. I don't know if I can afford him, so I'm going to take along, you have to make an appointment, so I'm going to take along one of my textiles, and I take it along and see how much it's going to cost, because I really would like that to be a kick-ass frame, you know. But apart from that, I'm casual, she says.
But then it's not just textiles, right? It's both of your artistic strands.
Well, with the stone, I do make plinths. I make my own plinths for everything. In terms of those little sort of semi-classical plinths, I make them. Because I get the idea of just to say elevating this humble food stuff and bringing attention to it by placing it on a pedestal. So I make those, yeah.
That's so good, because this is the thing that so obviously we're having a textile focused conversation, but the thing that has always blown my mind about you, among other things, but is the fact that you were a stonemason as well. And then I saw that talk that you did as part of the Mayday textile elements conversation. Mm-hmm. And in that there was something which I kind of want to come back to you later, but in which you said you don't feel like you're particularly a textile artist because you're a stonemason for a living. And there was a funny kind of there's a tension between those two forms.
I forgot what I said. that's not so much the case now. I am.
This was 2 years ago.
That's not so much the case now. I'm a lot more comfortable and settled. More comfortable using the term textile artist. I still feel, am I still a wee bit apologetic? I don't know. Not so much. I am accepting that people are, I think because people are curious about the dual practice. And they're that's fascinating for some people. So I'm not so apologetic. Yes, I know one of your questions is about being in the how do I see myself in the textile community, and I still don't think I am in the textile. I'm. Outside, but not in a hostile way. I'm not being kept, but I still feel a bit of a not a fraud.
No, but I mean, imposter syndrome comes anyway. Is it because, like, relatively speaking, you've not been textiling for a huge amount of time? Do you think that is part of it?
Well, I tell people, and I every now and again when I do a textile post on my stone page, I just do it to remind people to, yes, I started off with textiles before I started with stone. Mother being a dressmaker, and I did theatre wardrobe. I did, you know, O and A level embroidery, et cetera, et cetera. So I shouldn't feel, you know, and I've got all my embroidery books still. I shouldn't feel, but because I earn my living, but from stone, but I don't feel it. I don't feel so outside the loop as I used to.
I mean, to be honest, I think anybody who's an exhibiting artist and is trying to take their work to new levels butts up against the yes, but it's textiles story in any form. So I don't feel if you haven't gone through that, then you've not really been trying hard enough in some ways. It's almost like part of the journey. But I think, like, I mean, as you said, one of the things that's fascinating about your work is you've got these two strands. So you've got the stone masonry and you've got the textile art. But then also I think that you've just got this great story that you're telling, whether it's your personal story through your work or whether it's choosing to focus on like BIPOC icons. You've just got this great opportunity here to present a body of work that really, it not only challenges the textile art thing, but it pushes at all kinds of boundaries simultaneously.
I am aware that I'm dealing with these two very, very opposite mediums, you know, this elitist, and especially now I'm dealing with a lot of marble, this elitist, you know, white Italian marble. You couldn't get, you know,
it's get more Roman, did you?
And then with the textiles. But yes, but the subject matter,
It was just that thing of saying, you know, you've got the opportunity here to not only, you know, push forward as a textile artist, but you're having all these cultural conversations as well. So not only is there the story of textile as an art form, that's a load of bunkum, you've got all these other bunkum related issues that you can address.
I started off using the textiles before as art therapy, not knowing it was art therapy. So it started off for my mental health, you know. I used to use the sewing, my sewing machine then, and I used to use a lot more stitches then. But so it started off with, yes, for mental health and getting my demons out, and that's still the case. But then I don't know how the historic women of history, you know, the women of history started to come into it. Because of Instagram, around lockdown, I started to read a lot more history. Instagram pages started to come under my nose. I used to do history, and I used to love history. I did O and A level history, and at one point. This is back in the day, this was in the 80s, but they were quite good. I think I was doing A-level history. The teacher sent me off for a day course to SOAS, you know, School of African Oriental Studies, to do a course, one day course, because I wanted to look at Black history. So it was always there. But because of lockdown, and a lot of history books, Black history books, and all this other history started to come through, and I thought, holy shit! I can't remember which my very first one was. but it's they're again, they are very important to me. My favorite one. I think the very first woman of history that I thought, really, her name was Miss Lala. Her name was Miss Lala, and she was, as a matter of fact, at the moment, I think at Tate Britain, they've got a small exhibition about her, because she was depicted by Degas in several paintings and sketches. She was an acrobat. She was mixed race, of German and African extraction. She lived in Germany and she traveled with the troupe. So there is a small exhibition at the moment, which I've got to go to see what else they've unearthed. But she was the first. And I thought, so yes, I sold Miss Lala, you know, fairly quickly, but she was the first. But then they just started coming. So it's and I also deal with, it's the mental health, it's women of history, it's my own personal demons, because I say I had from the age of 12, you know, acne. So throughout my entire adult life into my 40s, and into my late 40s, 50s, I had troubled skin. So I had to put makeup, I had I'd take pills, and I was doing lotion. So I deal with that. I've covered that as well. And I think that's where several of my pieces, especially early ones, I'm hacking away at myself, either with knives, or I've developed the little icon figure I developed. She develops these sharp little nails, these claws, and I think with one of the textile pieces I've sent you. That's partly one. Again, these claws, and that's where the blood comes from. I'm just hacking away at myself, just to get down to new, lovely brown skin. I just want to get rid of the old, you know, the yucky stuff. So that I deal with that, and that's definitely something that I would never have talked about before. Never in a million years. I just kept that to myself. So when that started to materialize, I thought, fuck it. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Sorry, yeah. Karen.
You know, that was really, really, but then I wasn't showing my work. I wasn't showing my work to anybody. I was really doing that for myself. And getting that out there. But, you know, I have, you know, if I have put it on Instagram, I haven't talked about it. So I think some of those are early pieces that are on Instagram. But I think I might do a repost at some point with some, and do a wee explanation, I had a really good little a good talk with somebody at the Knitting Stitching Show with this young girl, and about those particular types of that avenue of that I go down, because she had troubled skin, and we had this lovely conversation, you know, so there's that as well. So there's that. And then there's also just how, as a black female, and now as a black, you know, a female, you know, on the, you know, middle age, you know, 60 next year, how I navigate through the world. And the irritations, the jokiness, you know, how I, you know, the the Pollyanna, you know, that textile is one of my favorites. And there's another one. I don't know if I've given it to you. The tortoise and the hare. I see myself. So I say 60 now, and things are beginning to happen for me. You know, things are beginning to bubble a little bit, and I've just got all about. You know, I don't see myself as an ambitious person. I've just been plodding along, but I've got there, or I'm getting there, I think, eventually. So yeah,
that's fascinating. I mean, so when you started making these pieces, in like you say, there was very much you're internally processing things and making the figures. And I mean, did you find that the production process was a useful tool in that respect? I mean, I guess stonemasonry is very meditative and very focused in its own way. But I mean, textiles is renowned for its slowness and for that, you know, reflection that you get when you're making it. So, I mean, clearly the way you've just been able to talk about the skin issues just now makes it feel like you found a certain amount of peace, or you've just processed a lot of rage. So the rage is a lot smaller. But I mean, can you talk about the process? Did like you have to do a series of certain pieces and then you can move on to other ones, or did you have a bunch of concurrent things, or did it all just come out like a torrent?
It came out like a torrent, yeah. Because say there was the early textile pieces, that was a different process. Then there was this gap. It was 2019. After seeing that documentary about with Faith Ringgold, and I thought, holy shit, I've got all those textiles from 2004. And then it was the whole, it was the Trump, it was Boris Johnson, it was Brexit, it was, you know, George Floyd. And these textiles just poured out of me. So what I tend to do is I'll start one and I just have to see it through. But if another idea comes, one idea can leapfrog over another. So there's one that I've done the drawing, and at the moment I've been doing that. One idea which is burning a hole in my brain, but I do the drawings for it. I will do the what I call the working tracings for it. But then something else, I think, so I can have two or three working drawings, you know, put aside, because this fourth one has to be done, and then I have to go back to the backlog. So I sometimes have maybe two or three bubbling, and then there's my sketchbook, which is full of doodles and what I tend to do is, because I use music a lot, as well as because I listen to music a lot in the studio when I'm carving, a title can just come to me and then I'll write it down, but then I will change the wording around. For example, one of them, but I don't think I gave you this, that one of my pieces is called A Hard Knock Life for Us.
Right. Yeah.
And it's three of my figures with, you know, cut lips and, you know, and they're standing on, I think, a little hill. I don't know if the water that they're the water that's surrounding them is the Union Jack. But anyway, but I got that from I think it's Jay-Z.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, it's either that or Annie, let's face it.
Like. Yeah, it's called the Knock Live, the Ghetto Anthem. And and I thought, I was listening to that when I was carving, and I thought, oh yeah, and the imagery, I can hear a line in a song, and imagery will just come to me. I had to quickly write it down and quickly do a really, really rough little sketch. And then, but sometimes I'll then change the words around. Another example of that, a very good example of that was, it's a Kate Bush song. And that was, I wrote it down. It's called Sat in Your Lap.
Right.
And there's a line in it that says, just when I think I'm king. And I thought, okay. So I wrote that down, and I crossed off king and put queen. And then I changed it. I started, and then just when I thought I was queen, and I did that. That's one of my, I think that's one of my early, not so early, the 2019 really complicated pieces where it took me a lot of time. I regard doing the textiles sometimes when they're really complicated, I regard it as a choreography of layers. I've got to work out, put that layer down first and then sew that layer on top, and then I can just stitch. So yes, I regard it as a choreography, and there was a lot, there was beading involved with that one. So yes, just when I thought I was queen, that was one of my first really meaty ones. Yeah, so yeah. I like my queens. I do. I've been doing.
I was going to say, yeah.
I do.
Queens is definitely a thing, isn't it? I love. Was it Queen in a World? Like, that was one of the first ones I think that really caught me when I was looking back at your work back in the day, because it's just so iconic. But that one's about you, right? That one's not a historical. I mean, it's got a historical.
I think it's about me. Yes. That was, yeah. That was my, yes. That was my first queen. That was, yes. Yeah, that's my first one.
Still a cracker.
Yes, it's like that term, being a legend in your own living room. That's how I view those. So yeah.
I think, I mean, to be honest, without getting too metaphysical for a minute, I think it's in the same way as it's important to stop and smell the roses. Mm-hmm. I think every now and again, it's important to feel like you're a queen. Do you know what I mean? Because life goes by pretty fast.
Yes.
And you got to take those moments when you can.
Yes, absolutely. I feel that. I think it's just the whole aging process. I feel that more. I've heard other women of my age, you just start to relax. You just start to relax, and you don't give a fuck, really,
I mean, I'm 10 years younger than you, but I'm heading towards 50, and the same thing. Like, the amount that you worry about the opinions of others just drifts away really pleasantly.
Yes. Yeah.
And you're like, it's such a relief, kind of.
Yeah. There's been, even before that, there was, every now and again, I would go through my bag lady phase. Being stone carver and being in work clothes Monday to Friday, stone carving. And I used to wear my steel toe cap boots nearly all the time. So going to and from work, sometimes I would just look like, I would just relax into it. I really did not care. So yes, I do more of my bag lady. Yeah, my bag lady face. Yeah, don't give a monkey. I can go to Sainsbury's and
because at the end of the day, who's filming it, live streaming it for a nation of people watching? Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
A phrase I use, I've been using a lot recently, especially this year, I found, I say, who cares? No one cares. No one's looking. It doesn't matter. I say that a lot to myself now. So, yeah.
I mean, there's a trade-off, isn't there? I recently went down to my local corner shop in a pair of Crocs, and I felt like I wasn't on holiday. It was just being a bit lazy, and I was like, am I losing my standards here? They're nice enough Crocs, you know, but it's a bit of a step, that one. So I think sometimes you've got to give yourself a bit of self-discipline, mate. I know what you mean. I'm not like thinking, oh, I don't care what people think if I'm wearing it. I'm just like going, Jamie, are you letting yourself go?
Oh, yeah, you strike a balance. Yeah, you strike a balance. Yeah. But.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about like the design of your characters, you know. It's a very iconic way of characterization.
Mm.
How did you get to that? How did you come up with this kind of figure?
When I finished at art college, Wolverhampton Poly, in the 80s, I didn't have any studio space. And so I came back to London and went back home to live with my mum. And I started doing these large paintings. And I still got them framed, and I was exhibiting some of them. They should come out of the woodwork at some point. That's where they came. And where they came from, I don't know. I think it was because I was carving at college these huge heads. And my degree show was made up of these huge heads, these huge noses and faces and eyes. And so in painting form, I still wanted to work big, naturally. They came about just somehow working in my bedroom, just painting these huge, huge, huge paintings. But yes, those paintings, I've got them in my lockup, and they were on books. I think that they were on a few book covers. Women Artists Slide Library used them in their diary back in the day, and maybe
there's still that sort of one-eyed, side-facing illustrative.
Yeah, there was that. They developed. And they went. One went to New York for an exhibition, But then they went. But then I said I forgot about them. How could I forget about them? I don't know. Say 2019, I unearthed all this work that I somehow had just gotten buried. I'd forgotten about, and all these paintings, and so that's how the figure started. This stylized cutout, almost, you know, this sort of golly like figure, I suppose, you know, this which she is this all encompassing how society, you know, I suppose, you know, a white society, but not just white society, how I'm seen as a black female, how I'm seen, the figure works, and you can put any kind of, yeah, she's a cutout doll, you can put any kind of clothing on her, just, you know, stick her out there into the world and see if she sinks or swims, you know. So yeah,
it's because it's interesting then, isn't it? Because yeah, so therefore you'd already kind of created that visual language when you were doing the paintings, and then you've come up with something which actually from a textile standpoint really easy to implement, whereas, you know, if you'd have decided to go down the portrait quilt trying to make it look like photorealistic or whatever, as some other artists do, you made yourself a ton of extra work.
So I used to use a sewing machine with my early pieces, but for some reason now I Yeah, these all have to be done by hand. And I think you mentioned earlier on about the process of it's textile work is a slow process, but I have deliberately taken a faster route, the fastest route I possibly can to get my ideas out. Because the ideas were the titles, the imagery were just pouring out of me. I needed to do it as quickly as possible. Hence, this style of appliqué developed. Mm. Because my stone carving is that very, 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 very slow process. Obviously it's quite monochrome stone carving, although you can, you know, paint if you want, and gilding is involved. So I think that when the first textile pieces I did, I think I sent it to you, was this long and short stitch. What's the name of the stitch? I forgot. They're called happy pills. And that was, it just took too long. Just took too long. I enjoyed the process, I just have too much to say. And so the applique work and the knot, well, to begin with, I was very, very random with my choosing of fabrics. I don't do that now. I'm much more careful. Again, it's all part of the choreography. So the textiles look quite higgledy-piggledy, but I very carefully chosen all the textiles. And I want that to blend with that. So there is a lot more thought in choosing my textiles, but I'm still relaxed. And it's still a lot quicker than doing how other textile artists work. That's why I suppose I still think I'm a bit of a fraud, because they do these beautiful stitches and I'm just slapping stitching, slapping a bit of, you know, beading on. but no, it's how I enjoy working. It works for me.
Because the other thing that occurred to me about the nature of the characters you choose,
uh-huh,
is that it's like a distillation, you know, in a way. I did a talk with Orlie Kogan, and she uses images of herself in her work, but she presents them as naked, and by doing so she turns them into fictions. Mm. She's like, this isn't me, this is a fiction. Mm. And in some ways the characters that you present are the same kind of thing.
Mm.
Because you're like disconnecting them from the human, but you're remaining with the story.
Yeah.
Like whether it's your stories about the personal issues, or whether you're telling histories of Black people. It's a really useful tool, I think. I wonder whether that's partly where the historical thing came through.
Yeah. Maybe it's a way of me. It's a way of me connecting with these unforgotten women in history. That's a good one. Okay.
Because it's an opportunity to tell their stories without getting hung up on having to make the inaccurate picture of them, or, you know, make historical, you know, find a photo and try and do them justice in that way.
Pick certain elements. I'll go with a photograph of them, and yes, deliberately pick certain elements. So it's, you know, to characterize that person. I don't go down lots and lots of details. It's still that little, it's still my figure. And it works, and that's all I need to, that's all I need to do. Now I'm stumbling here. But yes, no. Yes, basically yes. Yeah, whatever.
No, but I think that's the thing, because, you know, I was listening to that talk and you were saying about your process and how a lot of the time the decisions you make about fabric and the decisions that you make about the objects you include are all part of the storytelling. That's how the story is framed. And so it just gives you the opportunity to get to the essence of a person without needing, you know, it's like a historical fiction, but it's not. You're just telling a historical story.
Yeah, there are just certain motifs with each character that you need to tell their story. Miss Lala was more in her dress. She was upside down on a trapeze, you know, on a trapeze bar. And then that's Miss Lala.
I liked, was it Sister Rosetta?
Oh yes, Bach? yes. She was
the guitar.
Yes, she was. I think she's my latest historic one. I think yes, and that was very important because the picture I have of her, she's dressed all in white, and she's got this white guitar. But getting all white against white was tricky. So, but I still wanted. It's still important. With each history figure, I have an element of African fabric. So it says, yes, this woman is obviously, she's a woman of color because of the brown felt, but I always have to try to incorporate. Whether she's in America or German extraction, or, you know, I want to incorporate a little bit of African fabric into the story, just to underline to people that this is, you know, this is her background, this is her heritage.
Queen and Rosetta's the guitarist, Bessie Springfield. I do want to shout out to her as well because she's got the best motorbike.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yes. That motorbike was. Yeah, that was definitely choreographed. I wanted it predominantly white, because one of the pictures I saw, she was on this white motorbike. But in that, yes, I wanted the blue blood of happiness, there's definitely a bit of African fabric in there, and a bit of white leather work in that. So, yes, it was that was a lot of fun picking that. But there has to be a little bit of African fabric in there somewhere, just to underpin her story, her background. So yeah,
and you said as well that you use African fabric. It's kind of shorthand, isn't it, for anybody of a sort of, I guess, BIPOC background. That'd be fair to say, because you couldn't find Caribbean fabric so readily. I think that
yes. When I first started using the Lost Wax fabric or shorthand African fabric, I felt a bit of a fraud. I thought, well, I was having this conversation with. A Nigerian woman the other day, saying, I don't take it lightly, just banding about the word, you know, Africa. I do take it quite seriously, but it was the only way I could. It was the best fabric to just underline, just to denote my heritage. Yes, my heritage is West Indian, you know, Jamaican. But as you say, there isn't in terms of fabric, with such a beautiful variety, there isn't that. So I gave myself permission, and I'm okay with it now.
But because you also do other things, don't you? I think you said you sometimes you use chintzy fabrics because that gives us a suggestion of Britishness.
Oh yes.
But then whenever your characters are standing on hills, that's meant to represent England. Is that right?
Yes, yes. The little hillocks that they stand on are usually on a chintz, or sometimes I use the Union Jack flag itself. So I've got some fabric that printed the Union Jack on. And or even sometimes the hillock is surrounded by, I do these little sort of waves of the Union Jack mm-hmm. to denote, you know, we are an island. I'm on an island. So yeah, it's that's a shorthand. And the background I started to use quite early on. I didn't realize I was using the background, a chintz background, to say, this is where I live. The majority are white English, and this is the country I live in, and I'm a little black figure in this country, and hence the hillock as well. So the background is usually chintz, quite often chintz, and hillock. But sometimes, you know, just this plain. Sometimes the subject matter just needs a plain background. I quite often use bed sheeting as well. That's quite useful. So, but yes, old curtains, old tablecloths.
And are there certain kind of, like those kind of rules, if you like, rules of construction that you use, do they tend to follow when they're more personal pieces, and then maybe the historical pieces you have a different flavor in the construction?
Well, the motorcycle one, I get gifted fabric, and obviously I go rummaging around, you know, for all sorts. But I was given that fabric. I'd had it for ages, and it was really hot. And because it was a motorcycle queen of Miami, I really wanted to use that fabric. I had to use that fabric, that background, and it really worked. I'm so pleased. I was determined that, you know, yes, she's in white, and so it all had to work and pop together. But yes, it was this hot reds and golds, and it just denoted Miami, yes, for me.
And it is, it's interesting actually, because it's almost, you've got that daredevil feel about it. It almost feels like she's behind this like flaming hoop or something, isn't it? There's a real like power to it.
That worked really well. I'm so pleased with that. Yeah, she's going into the show. I really love her.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NWDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time.